Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. This is a dark occulted mysticism special where we have co-host Freighter X and a very special guest who's a specialist in the occult world on with us for a few cackles at the various dark occulted mysticism wails and wiles of the New World Order and scumbaggery agenda and whatnot. And our guest today is James Wright, formerly of the Supreme Council in Dallas. James, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Vinny.
Greetings, James.
Hello, Frater.
Now, where do we go from here? Because we're all very familiar with the topics, and we're all very familiar with each other. Is there anything new on the horizon? Because I got nothing.
Well, I've got something new.
Yes, you do.
I've got a couple of things. So you're talking about the document that I sent you today, James?
Yeah, I read the pages you said, and that was always amazing. You know, fun.
Well, I've got those quotes right here. I've written down a few of the quotes from the pages of a document that I sent to James today, which is basically the playbook, really, of the Illuminati in many cases, or at least the playbook of the social engineers or global power elite of this country, you know, and probably of England and any other Western nation out there, you know. But it's a document that was written in 1973. It's the United States Government Commission report from SRI International entitled Changing Images of Man, which is edited by Willis W. Harmon and O.K. Markley, which included It's this idea that they put forth in 1973 that there was a new values and a spiritual revolution occurring in America, an ecological awareness and a self-realization movement, and that it was becoming virtually unstoppable based on this commission report. And this would bring about what they said, a transformation of our society that would radically undermine modern industrial state culture and institutions and result in serious social disruptions, economic decline, runaway inflation, and even institutional collapse. You know, this was their prediction. So this report anticipates a lessening of trust in the authority and a reaction against regimented lifestyle, tightly controlled society. It also suggested ways of preventing this worst case scenario. And this is the reason why this is so important, Vinny, because this is the smoking gun, if you will, of documentation from a government agency, which at this time in 1973 was right in bed with the CIA, with the NSA, with the Department of Defense. In 1973, George Herbert Walker Bush was, in fact, on his rise to becoming the director of the CIA. And this was the last days of the official MK Ultra program when they said that they ended it, you know, in the mid 70s. But we can all speculate. Is I believe they just stepped it up to nationwide. But basically, so this is the documentation of a government government agency that was saying, okay, here's what you can do. Some suggested ways of preventing this would be scenario, preventing the worst case of scenario, identifying existing institutions and traditions that could be used to control and contain the impetus of the new movement, this new thought revolution, this new thought movement. And one of the best solutions recommended, wait for it, were the traditions of Freemasonry, were the iconography of ancient Egypt. And a quote from the report, of special interest to Western world is the Freemasonic tradition. It played such a role in the birth of the United States of America that this has a potentiality of reactivating the American symbols and reinterpreting the work ethic supporting the basic concepts of a free enterprise democratic society and providing new meaning for the technological industrial thrust. And as we've said, this timing of this report is so remarkable. And one last little point of it that they make from the report is that it is under these symbols, Masonic and Egyptian, and principles and goals properly understood, and no others, it's stressed, no others, that the differing viewpoints within the nation of the United States can ultimately be reconciled. And that's just one little section of what, like a 300, almost a 300 page report, right, James?
Yeah. I mean, for me, seeing stuff like that, and then, of course, Vinny and I just each had Dr. Colin Ross out of Dallas as a guest on our shows, and what he brings to the table and then something like this, a document, you know, it's validating for me because I've been saying the entire time, just quoting Fred Kleinecht, you know, in 85 when he wrote Your Amazing Mystic Powers for the Supreme Council of the Scottish Rite. Brazenly admitting that yeah, they fund that. And then, you know, Dr. Ross is a guy coming from the angle of a doctor who's saying, yes, he's done his homework on the subject, and the Scottish Rite comes up again and again with funding. And so, yeah, it's validating to read something like that. It's not shocking at all to me, but that's me.
So how does it feel to actually know that you're part of these organizations, or were part of it in James' case?
Absolutely, just disgustingly filthy, Vinny.
Well, let's talk about that though for a moment. Okay, so what we've pointed to is a government agency reporting a government agency actually paying for commissioning a report from a private corporation, an international corporation, which is basically saying that Masonic iconography and Masonic symbolism and Egyptian iconography are what we can use to kind of corral everybody's awareness back into the civic mythology fold.
How do they plan to do this? Do they plan to use it through imagery and advertising, media, etc.?
Well, I guess you can use the Dark Horse music video of Katy Perry's recently as a direct.
Well, we're on the tail end of it. Think of it, guys. We're on the other end of it. I mean, this was 1973 when this report came out. So obviously they were full on from that point to now. You just look at any movie, TVs, music. I mean, the Masonic symbolism and Egyptian iconography are everywhere. That's what Freeman has spent the last 10 years, you know, chronicling the Masonic symbolism hidden in everything.
I've spent probably the last year or so when I watch movies on my computer taking screenshots every time I see Masonic symbolism, and every single Hollywood film I see, there's at least two or three screenshots from it.
And here's your explanation. Here's why. Here it is.
So what's the mechanism? Specifically, how did they get – I mean, are they in bed with the producers of the film? Are we looking at specific filmmakers who are Masonic? Because I've seen a lot of Donald Sutherland films that are heavy on the Masonic symbolism, and he also mentions the number 33 in a number of films. There's his offices and things of that nature, and his apartments in the Puppet Masters and the Body Snatchers, and a number of other films all have black and white tile floorings. So
sure,
you come to the point where I'm starting to think: is there a strain? Is there a flood? Is there an inlet, a doorway, or something of that nature which you step through, where you kind of have the say so about productions and ensure that at least this little thing is put in there, or is it simply bought and paid for marketing, much like product placement? So Coca-Cola would come in and would say, we'll give you $200,000 if your character drinks a Coke in this movie. Or the Supreme Council of the 33rd Degree comes into a Hollywood producer and says, we'll give you $1 million if you put a pyramid with an all-seeing eye in a picture on the wall, and another $1 million if you put a Masonic floor somewhere in the film.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I totally buy that that's exactly what's happening. But what I would more be willing to see, or more willing to imagine happening, would be multitudes of people from all different walks of life for all different various reasons being drawn to, you know, like, for example, myself, you know, what was the big deal? Why was I drawn to the Masonic Lodge? Why was I drawn to the symbolism? Do you know how many people in the last 3 years have contacted me personally by email or Skype or Facebook who say the same exact thing to me? I'm thinking about joining the lodge. I've spent my whole life being, you know, my adult life, you know, being preoccupied with this. What's, you know, what do you think? And it just continues to reinforce to me over and over again that quite possibly we've all been conditioned, like resonant frequency, you know, conditioning to just, because we're being saturated, our awareness is being saturated with the symbolism, we're drawn to it, we're open to it, and we feel like there's a affinity there. There's a relationship already with our awareness that we weren't aware of because it was being injected in us subliminally, you know? We weren't even paying attention when we were kids. I mean, how many hours did you spend, like me, Vinny, staring at the TV screen when you were growing up? I mean, all that image is just soaking up into your brain. And then, of course, later on in life, when you see a Masonic symbol on a temple or a lodge, or you hear reference to it in movies as a grown-up, it sparks something in you that's a memory now with an emotional attachment, but it was all planted there before.
Like play toy cigarettes or something like that, and a child goes on to become a smoker.
Exactly. The same psychological marketing going on. Exactly the same. And that is really the key thing here, is that so that's why I wanted to make the distinction. I wouldn't say the Supreme Council was paying
I'm not talking about literally. I'm talking
but I wanted to be clear that I think that you're onto something, but I don't think it's specifically that. I think it would be more along the lines that they'd be willing to be quote unquote creative consultants, right, James? They'd be like behind the scene creative consultant associate producers, you know?
Yeah, I think it's the same thing in politics, is it's always these dark consultants lurking in the shadows that you have to take more notice of and what they're up to, yeah.
With their dark consulted mysticism.
The dark consulted mystics, you know? And they're basically the ones who are considered the experts in the room. So any question of any call that has to be made, either black or white, left or right, they turn to the consultant and say, what do you think? And there's his moment. His agenda, if he's already on track, you know, he's on track, he's just going to keep consistently pushing for this, what is a consistent message.
Maybe, you know, maybe the three of us should cash in on this, and we can start our own company and say that we're a marketing consulting firm, very elite, you know, and snotty and all that, and we can sell Hollywood Masonic symbolism music video or whatever ideas.
I don't know, man. I think they're all tapped out. They're working from a different angle nowadays. You
with
know?
Your accent, James, you can make it work.
No, your accent, Vinny.
You know, it's true. The Hollywood people do love New Zealanders. I think it's because they saw the Lord of the Rings one too many times.
Well, and Fly to the Conchords, yeah.
The thing is, guys, they got a captive audience because everybody hungers for knowledge. Everybody wants to know answers. We're all
sitting
here.
If you say so, not everybody, mate.
Well, no, it's on some level, man. Come on, everybody hungers for some sort of answer. What, you know, why questions? Even the most basic person has a, you know, why am I not getting paid enough or something? Maybe I don't.
I'm
know.
Still
maybe
not convinced, bro.
Okay, you can make a good point, actually. I stand corrected, but
and it's not because they've decided not to be questioning on their own, it's they've had that questioning nature beaten out of them sufficiently by somebody. Not all of us have had it completely beaten out of us yet.
That's true. Or conditioned, you know.
At a young age.
Right, coercive methods. But inevitably, I think enough people are still wanting to know the answers. Those people that remain steadfast to quest even after
Even after the babies come along and interrupt the show.
Yeah, right. No, even after they've had the conditioning put on them, some of us persist in questioning. Some of us persist in saying it's not enough to be spoon-fed this white bread version. Whoa.
Mm.
Now, that's a new experience.
Now, it seems to me that there's something different about us, and I don't know if it's true, but we've been looking at James's bloodlines and stuff like that back in the day, and I wonder if I've got bloodlines that trace back that are of resistance or kingship or something like that, or if Alex Jones does, or any other kind of like great kind of, you know, a foot in the front door resistor of our times.
Well, isn't that a pretty good chance, Vinny? Isn't that a pretty good chance, considering you live in New Zealand and most of the people are descended from some sort of, you know, that the people who were brought there because they were not fitting in real well back in England, right?
No, that's Australia.
No, isn't it New Zealand as well?
No, New Zealand was mostly kind of people who weren't doing quite well financially, who would kind of, you know, need to get a loaf of bread in the street or whatever. You could either live in the crowded cities in the coal smoke and the filthy streets covered in horse dung, or you can help us populate this new colony that we've got. Here's a ship. It's 9 months at sea, and you'll have a bit of land when you get there. Who wouldn't take that opportunity? The people who had already broken laws and were the outcasts of society, on the other hand, got sent to Australia rather than New Zealand.
And America before that.
Well, I think more like America was discovered a wee bit before that, you know, because New Zealand has only really been settled for a couple of hundred years, whereas the United States is like 400. What happened was, when we're talking about immigration into a particular place, origin stories are actually quite important. I was just thinking about this before coming on the show today, about ancestry and knowing where you come from, knowing your roots, and how much power that actually gives you, just having that wee amount of knowledge. It's not a greatly exaggerated field of study, as far as I know, knowing where we all come from, is it? It's not in our faces every single day. It's something that they don't want us to know. And by they, you know what I'm talking about, just general scumbaggery.
Well, yeah, I mean, James, did you have something you wanted to say?
Oh, well, about that genealogy stuff. I mean, yeah, that's something that they definitely don't want everybody knowing. That's why I enjoy being rather in your face about it, the issue and all of that. I mean, I'd be willing to stake the farm that Vinny has it, and we know you do, frater, and a great deal of other people that are in broadcasting have it, and that's sort of a strange synchronicity. Like, your most successful people in Hollywood are all, you know, related to those bloodlines, so it's food for thought. But I don't know what else. I mean, you got to go and check it out, and sometimes that can be very grueling with, you know, getting your information together and all that type stuff and entered in and so forth. But in some cases, it's really easy because you only get back like three or four generations, and then, you know, boom, you hit that world tree and it takes off from there. So, I'd be willing to.
a little aside on genealogy. I mean, you know, they have the whole Mormon family search that everybody talks about on the internet.
Oh, they're real into it. Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, a few years ago, I first became aware of them probably at this point now, it was 10 years ago almost. And it was when I was really trying to find, I first come to realize that I had some heritage to look up, you know. And of course, it goes back to the whole social engineering program of like not wanting people to have tradition through family heritage, because it's important that they just feel like family doesn't matter. So you'll go off to the salt mine or, you know, factory and work, and then go off to the war and do what you're supposed to and lay your life down for the state. But that's par for the course. But the whole thing with Mormon Family Search, I discovered the, do you know why the Mormons have been gathering all those people's names and everybody's family's history for so long, Vinny?
No idea.
It turns out that back in 1840 something, the Mormons started a practice of basically after you died, they'd go through the records of people who had already died and they'd take their names and they'd stand in, they'd have live members of the church stand in their place and baptize these people into the Latter-day Saint Church after death.
So, oh yeah, that yeah the yeah I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, so that's what they do up to today. They
yeah, because Mitt Romney had it done to his
everybody's
or,
had it
or no, his wife had it done to her father or something like that.
Vinny, if you have any family members that are listed in the Mormon Family Search database, I've looked for my family and they're all listed there. My clan is there, right? It says at the bottom of the data, it's somewhere in the fine print. I have printed off documents. It says at the bottom of the page, it'll say born, died, you know, for the listing in the genealogy. And then it'll say baptized into LDS. And it'll be like a 20th century date. And the person died in like 19th century or 18th century.
I mean, talk about your
desperation. I'm sending you a hilarious link in the text box. You click this and have a good laugh.
No, but let's just think about the desperation of a church that needs to swell its numbers and ranks that much that they that they've run out of live people that they can convince. So.
Well, you know, that's probably – no, I think it's a quota or something. They have, like, to have a certain number of converts. Each person has to bring in a certain – so they were like, we got to get them from somewhere. We got to hit up the cemeteries.
Well, I guess they would like me because I just ran the little genealogy calculator or whatever, and their prophet, Joseph Smith, is my seventh cousin eight times removed.
Yeah.
So that's the curse of the Smiths. You're still causing trouble for the Mormons or the Masons, because we know that obviously Joseph Smith was not popular among the Masons.
Yeah, that's why they shot him.
Well, let's be more specific. Probably why they if they were the ones that shot him, probably why is because he basically ripped off the first 7 degrees of Freemasonry and made him Temple Mormonism degrees. The endowments of Mormonism are Masonic degree signs of recognition, handshakes, secret words, ritual, everything. It's all Temple Mormonism is basically a ripoff of the first 7 degrees of Freemasonry.
Except, of course, the magic underwear.
Well, that's just a – when you call –
that's
you consider
when it
that,
goes up a few more degrees.
That just makes them special. But it's basically the whole apron. It's just taking the apron to a different level or, you know, like combining it kind of with like the Essene linen, you know, the whole linen where they wore white linen, the scene supposedly.
Is it kind of like, is there like a backless version that your wife can wear?
Well, you better have a backless version too, you know, because I don't know what the plumbing facilities were like at that point. I don't know.
I'll take that as a yes.
That's room for canned laughter.
All right.
Because, of course, we didn't mention that the Dark Cult of Mystic Show is being recorded before a live studio audience today.
Yeah. Can we get the studio audience to like call out and give us a big round of applause just to like proof of life or something?
Yeah, right here. Hear it? Hear it? Wow, amazing.
I can barely hear it at all. It's like distance in the background, which is good because it doesn't actually mess with the audio that we're actually recording here. It's just some kind of like distant mosquito noise in the back, yeah.
No, we can't hear the applause through the bulletproof glass.
It's important that you remain there, too. You have that Pope. You're in the Pope vehicle for this interview.
I was just about to do the Pope vehicle line.
Oh, man. I bit the rhyme. Sorry, man.
No, it's great minds think alike time, isn't it? Now,
of course,
yes.
Going through the genealogy and all of that kind of stuff, I also am very interested to know like how people are actually raised and stuff and what happens to them, because I probably wasn't raised the best, you know. Daddy beat me and he ran off when I was 10. How many boys have that got that story, that kind of thing? I used to be a real violent kid. Then I stopped being violent. Now, what is it within our general society that is causing all of this? I mean, you see this kind of like the superstructure, if you will, of defathering, bad raising, no lineage, brainwashing throughout the entirety of your life, going from one institution to the other. Kids go into primary school, high school, then go off to university before they've even gotten their first job or had or even done any traveling or had any life experience outside of frickin' high school. And all of a sudden they're going from one institution to another. And after that, there's a postgraduate study. Or unless they're doing even higher education, which gets them into further even debt, which gives them knowledge that they can't even frickin' use in the real world, they go out and they get a real job for a minimum wage that doesn't even pay the tuition fees. Nothing works in this society for people who tell you what society should do for you. You know, have you ever noticed that? Work real hard for somebody else and you become real successful. It's like, no, it's not, bro. If you work real hard for somebody else, what they'll do is they'll take the prime years of your life and steal all of your good ideas during the most productive and creative years of your life in order to enrich themselves and further enslave your ass.
Yeah, well, you were talking about the marketing executive end of things in Hollywood and that imagery and everything else. But it's we should also note the mechanism of control that's in place, whether, you know, whatever dodgy direction that it comes from, it doesn't really matter because, like, last night, for example, is the perfect example of how it works. I was laying in bed and decided for some odd reason, I think I'll flip on Coast to Coast AM and see what they're talking about. And I turn it on and it's, you know, the topic is Illuminati this or demons that and whatever, the usual. And a caller calls in and starts going on a very poised and articulate, calm rant about the forces of the New World Order and this, that, the other, and Illuminati, blah, blah, blah. Well, so he's on for quite a while. It's like a couple of minutes that they're letting this guy go on because he's really good as a caller. I guess you know how that goes. And so what he's saying starts to evolve, and he finally goes and says the F word, Freemasonry, and George Norrie cuts him right off. I mean, not even thank you, goodbye, nothing, just hang up. Next caller.
Oh, and we'll talk about this after the break when I cut you guys off. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. We're talking about Freemasonry on the Dark Occult of Mysticism special of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My co-host for today is Fader X, and our very special guest is James Wright, formerly of the Supreme Council. Now, you were just talking about George Norrie hanging up on a call right after he mentions the word Freemasonry. Now, I wonder how deep the infection goes. I mean, if we are talking about a cognitive infiltration of the power centers of society via the vehicle of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, how deep does it really go? I mean, how many mechanisms in society is there a Masonic influence?
Ooh.
Are there any that are free from it?
Well, that's that. The power lies in the power of their networking. So it's one of those things where you never know. Like when I was doing KFKA in Denver, I lucked out. I happened to be at a local CBS affiliate where there were no Masons in the joint running anything. So I was allowed to be on air there for about a month before the local lodge, which was only three doors down from the radio station, made a big stink and threatened this and threatened that. And it, you know, completely demonstrated every allegation that I make about them. We don't threaten as they threaten. And so my time there ended. I guess the pressure was too much or someone got scared or whatever. But Yeah, it could be anywhere.
So it stands to reason that if they hear about it, they can do something about it, no matter where you are.
Well, yeah, they get really butthurt about it. And so, like, my book signing that I was supposed to have on Hollywood Boulevard that day back in April of last year, it was going off without a hitch, the planning of it, and it looked like we were ready to go. And 3 days beforehand, the lesbian couple that owns the bookstore where it was going to be held called me in, you know, coming to talk to us in person. So I did, and they confided to me in a very concerned, shaken manner that there had been literally 24 Masons into their store in pairs for the entire week, every day prior, and had, you know, given these veiled threats. So they interpreted that as, like, so if we hold this event, our store could be firebombed or something.
Okay, listen, can we come back to a couple of things that you guys have said that I wanted to address?
Yeah, yeah.
I really want to, you know, the point you just made, I don't want to take away from that, though, about the firebombing. That was intense, the whole threat. I remember when that – you told me about that before, but I just wanted to address – you keep asking the question, Vinny. You keep saying, well, first the question was, you know, why? Why? What's going on here? Why the breakdown in the family? Why this? What's the cycle? What's the plan? And I think that it's really easy to locate and isolate the plan. The MO here is the literal breakdown of the family structure, because it's that whole Prussian model of society again. The idea that we need to, you know, the family structure, the what is the real holy trinity if not the father, the mother, and the offspring? That's the most holy trinity there is. There's nothing stronger than a bond, a balanced relationship between a man and a woman. There's no stronger relationship in the universe. That nothing can break them. Nothing could stop their initiative. They can move forward. You know, they can accomplish anything if they put their minds to. And that's what scares those who would control our world. And so the first thing that they saw as a prescription, we need to conquer this culture. We need to set the sexual roles in an imbalance, you know, put one over the other, and then to break the family unit up, you know, to make mom and dad obsolete, which you do by compulsion schooling, putting the kids in school and convincing them that everything that they're learning is much more than their family and parents could teach them, and to think that their family or parents are useless or not even worth their attention. And then the breakdown of the family further by sending dad off first to the mines or the factory where he works away from the house and nobody gets to see him. Nobody knows what he does. Nobody knows, you know, it's an anonymous existence. He comes home exhausted and sits in front of the hearth or in the front of the TV and that's it. And then, or the story that Vinny mentions where the culture moves forward to a place where they find that it's even better if we break the family up even more, break up the marriage, because now we've got two tax brackets, two demographics to tax households. Dad's got to live somewhere else where he'll be taxed. Mom will be living here where she'll be taxed. You know, if she needs social services, we can get her on the social teat so she'll be dependent upon our culture. And then, you know, all the package that comes along with that. But along the way, what does it do? It creates individuals who are open to persuasion. And that's, you know, so that's it. And then you mentioned the question of the Scottish Rite. To what level are they involved, and to what degree do they dictate these policies? I don't, even though I've isolated the Scottish Rite as the main culprit in my thesis, The Secret War Inside Freemasonry, I wouldn't say that worldwide it is the Scottish Rite that is the main culprit. I would say the team that are the main culprits are Scottish Rite Freemasons as well. They just happen to also belong.
What if, you know, they've simply infiltrated all the other aspects of Freemasonry, Blue Lodge, York Rite, Shriners, Golden Dawn, the whole lot of them, the whole gamut of different occult orders? The Scottish Rite Masons come in, they become members, they work their way up, and they basically seize control of the organization, more or less turn them into the Scottish Rite.
Well, James can attest to this. I know he can. What they do is they just watch people and individuals. They watch what they're capable of. They judge by their actions. People will show their moral compass, and they'll be noticed. And those who feel that this person would be useful in this order because of where their moral compass is at, they're tapped and invited to join that order. And those orders, as we know, now we're, you know, the numbers we get, they grow all the time. It starts off, I hear there's a couple of hundred dependent orders. Then it's 500, then it's 600, then it's 800. Now it's 1,200, I heard in a new book. You know, I mean, it's just endless numbers of psi-dependent orders where the predicated membership requirement is that you belong to a Blue Lodge first.
Well, I kind of liken it to regardless of whichever order you're citing in a conversation, it's almost kind of like when you have Italian in you, say you're half Italian or a quarter Italian or a tenth Italian or whatever, you'll always be welcome in a room of Italians. Like how that works, you just with
sure.
social attitudes and all, that's how these orders are very much so. Like, even though on the surface, at the public view, they may not sit there and, like, you know, the Scottish Rite loves to say we hate the OTO, but they actually enjoy quite a close relationship behind closed doors. So
they have this kind of communicative thing. Like, is there a Scottish Rite equivalent to the Italian "How you do"?
Yeah, there would be the P2 Lodge, I guess. But they do have Scottish Rite in Italy, actually. I believe that's where that Leo Zagami character claims to have gone through.
I thought Leo Zagami was a kind of pastor.
I'm not sure what he is, and
or a
I'm
way
not
of
even
folding
tempted to speculate.
Out of paper.
Mm-hmm. Or a genuine alchemist who can turn lead into gold.
Holding him up into working tools, the papers.
As long as he's got papers, he's all right with me, bro.
Hey, I hear you, man. He's a friend indeed.
Indeed.
No, but seriously, folks. Ba-dum-bum. No, really, though. I mean, the fact of the matter is that it is like that. You are a kind of... There is a certain nod, a gesture. That's why, you know, people wear pins and they have stickers on their cars and badges on their cars and stuff, because they know if a cop is a Mason, you got a better chance. I've got stories, my own personal experience where I got out of a situation where I had a big smelly bag of weed in my pocket. I'll just admit it. And I was standing there and this cop was not a Mason in my hometown, small hometown. But all the other officers who outranked him were, and they all were below me in rank in the lodge. And I'm standing there, and he's got me. I got no license on me. I did have a license. I just didn't have a copy of it on me. And I'm standing in my own driveway in my car, but I got a bag of weed in my pocket, and he's calling me on. He's saying, "You got this in your pocket. I can smell it on you." And I'm like, "Well, I don't know what you're talking about." And so he calls it in, and the desk sergeant on the job, he heard my name, and I know that he just said, "Let him go." Man, I could see the cop inside the car freaking pissed. I mean, he was livid. He was so mad. He came out. He was shaking. The anger handed me back. Oh, no, he didn't even have anything. Oh, I had my proof of registration, I guess. So he handed me back the paper, and he was like, "If I ever catch you on the road without your license, you're going to jail." You know what I mean? And he walked away. But I knew that I totally got off because I was a member of the lodge.
Oh, yeah, I would have upwards of 50 some odd speeding tickets on my record, my driving record, if not for being a Mason. Instead, I have zero. So, yeah, they used to pull up on the side of me, like on the freeway, especially where I love to speed, and, you know, just motion for me to slow down. They'd roll down their window and go, "Now, brother, you should set a better example than that."
Yep, my father, same way in my hometown. He was in the Golden Circle. That's what they called it, like Knights of the Golden Circle. They called it the Golden Circle. Anybody in the Golden Circle in my little town, you could speed by a cop doing whatever speed, and they would just, like, wave their hands down, like, with the gesture of, "Slow down, slow down," but they wouldn't do anything.
So the control structure and the separation of classes is actually a very vivid reality if you're a high-ranking Mason.
Vinny, you just said the magic words. Let's talk about that for a moment, James. The story you broke on your show, as a matter of fact, the DuPont scumbag there, who got off on any kind of prison for basically raping his own children, little children, and because they said tiny children, infants, and they said in the paper that it was, you know, guys like him have a hard time in prison, Vinny. And it wouldn't really help him to go to prison. It'd be more, this is a female judge saying it would be more helpful for him to have, you know, counseling and sexual offender counseling than do a day in jail, Vinny.
For raping infants.
For raping his own infants. His wife was testifying against him.
Now, you do realize.
And you know why? Great grandson of DuPont.
Now, you do realize that the reason why those people are treated so terribly in prison is it's called punishment.
It's called justice.
Uh-huh.
Right? That's part of the deal. Sorry, pal. Should have thought of that before you went where you went.
Yeah. I mean, there's some things that are just completely inexcusable, which any moral fabric or fiber in an ordinary person would not cut.
It's just sick. And then there's the no greater example. It's just like when I was in college back in the 90s and O.J. Simpson got off and the crowd of people in the cafe cheered. And I'm standing there looking at everybody like, what are you cheering for? The realization that the justice is farce in America, that you can buy your way out of anything, even murder, even cold-blooded murder. You can buy your way out of it if you have enough money.
Well, and it's not just that. It's the surveillance aspect to it as well, which has been a continued learning curve for me doing this because, like the story that I was telling you about the bookstore in Hollywood, so there was more left to that story. So I leave. We have this conversation. They express their deep concerns, and I leave. I walk out. I'm parallel parked in front of a meter at the intersection of Hollywood Boulevard and Cahuenga, which is one of the busiest. You know, you're talking wall-to-wall people all day, all night, tourists, everything. It's just a phenomenally busy intersection. So spotting someone in that crowd is going to be enormously difficult. And I was only at that store for about 10 minutes to have the conversation that we had, and when I walked out and walked up to my car, someone had drawn a square and compass in the dirt on my back windshield. So, I mean, they were watching even then.
That's freaking creepy, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've got a million of them. Those are just, that's just one story. James could pull out a bunch of those kind of crazy stories.
See, and here's the other part, is the brothers that just sit back and go, no, it's not possible, you know. There's only one rule, you know, believe in a supreme being. And it's like, bro, you're saying that this ancient Masonic order and whatnot that's descended from freaking King Solomon's teachings and blah, 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 has an idea that there's a supreme being, but in thousands of years, they haven't figured out or even had any idea what that is, and that's what they're telling you, and you just got to believe there's something up there?
Well, I think Fratter will agree with me when I say that if there's good guys in the ranks of Freemasonry, which of course there are, who would like to do something about it or would like to see it change, then my suggestion with my knowledge of it is they need to each go to their grand lodges and the Scottish Rite Supreme Council as well, take in all of them, and they need to amend that pesky little item in quote-unquote Masonic law that you are not allowed – it's a Masonic offense to criticize Masonry privately, not just publicly but privately. And with that in place, that's kind of like a, well, here there goes any kind of checks and balances we could have ever had with the place. So that would be, I would think, a good starting point to try and cleanse the halls of – Freemasonry by allowing that kind of feedback and discourse through from its more kind-hearted, level-headed members.
That might come back to bite you when you get 50 speeding tickets in the mail.
Well, no. Because they never would write the ticket, you see. So it was always just a wave, brush off, you know.
Yeah. It's not like a Masonic wave with like a finger gesture or anything like that. It's just they've seen the decal on your car and just, yep.
Or the ring on your finger, yeah.
But, you know, it's all such a farce, guys. It's not even enough anymore for me to do, you know, like the. I mean, I guess in the way I had mercenary motives coming into the lodge to begin with because I really wanted to know what was going on. I just wanted to know. I wanted to, satiate my curiosity. I'd read on it so much. I'd obsessed about it so much and I knew I could never know for real until I was initiated and went through it. And so I did it with that intention. And then, of course, in the back of my mind, of course I was, you know, I have to be honest, I was not going to not take advantage of any kind of advantages I might gain. You know, I mean, I definitely was thinking in terms of, hey, if I could better my existence, better my family's, you know, condition and state. I mean, if the world goes in the direction of a police state, maybe I'm going to have a gang sign I can throw to get through a checkpoint here and there. You know what I mean? Whatever. Whatever I can use it for, I'll take it, you know, is what, out of fear and desperation, you know, feeling like the, you know, we really don't have a lot of support or the, you don't have that mafia family to back your moves. You know what I mean? You're on your own, thrust upon a continent of a lot of aggressive and adversarial entities all around you, the people involved. But I'm at the point now where I've almost utterly, completely lost any kind of faith in Freemasonry. I've told James earlier today that I've gone to my last lodge meeting. I'm sick to death of it. I can't even stomach it anymore because it is such a farce and it's such a waste of time and money and effort to be involved with something that could even, if it's even a fraction of what we suspect. And then on top of it, the BS, nothing of inherent worth or value. James knows what I'm talking about. In the majority of the activities involved in Freemasonry are wastes of time and money and effort.
Sounds like high school.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways it is. Would you not agree, James, that statement I just made?
Yes, or call it the book definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over and over, expecting different results. That is a Masonic lodge meeting.
Yeah,
well, I mean, like literally, take us through it step by step. What's a lodge meeting like?
Okay, so you get in there, and you've got your usual cast of characters, the busybody know-it-all guys that are always already there, and they're, you know, the guys that'll sit on the sidelines and murmur and criticize, you know, those kind of people. And these days, it's those are the only guys there. They've driven everybody else out. I mean, there's nobody in the lodges I have gone into in the last year, the last 3 years. I mean, really the last 7 years on a steady decline to the last 3 years of it being merely enough people or not enough people to even open a meeting. You have to have a quorum, you know, the bare minimum members to open a lodge or a chapter or a council or anything. And so if you don't have enough people in the room, it's like you showed up for nothing. But if you do have enough people, you basically have people who they get in their roles. You can sense that it's just a rote repetition. Nobody's really interested. Most people are reading out of the book. They're not really even trying. There's a lot of joking and backslapping kind of stuff. If there's any kind of levity, that's all you got, is sort of like irreverent. You know, the kind of stuff that you could probably get right involved in, Vinny.
Well, but we were, like all the other young guys, you and I took it enormously seriously and certainly played by the rules. And
sure,
all of that military precision and robotic verbiage and everything else, that was fine with everybody. But it's when you go beyond that and you're having your hand slapped for trying to do anything out of context of their little white collar image they want going on with the public, and then you're bad. And like the way they'll sit there and demonize the OTO, but most high ranking Freemasons belong to it, and you will find them at OTO Oasis meetings. So,
well, wait a minute. Let's talk about the hand slapping thing so people can understand what you mean by that, because it's a context that you get a clear understanding if you understand what's expected of the members going into the lodge. When you show up for what's called a stated communication, a monthly business meeting that most lodges in America have, when you show up, you're expected to be ready to play a part in the ritual of some kind, if asked, or you've already been assigned a part. And there's two kinds of rituals. There's a ritual to just open and close a lodge, and there's also initiation degree rituals that are different than just opening and closing a lodge. You don't have to do a degree in initiation rituals if you're just opening and closing a lodge to do business. But if you have candidates or people that are progressing to another level, then that's a separate whole little function. People will switch parts. They'll go from like being an officer in the lodge for an opening to a different part for the degree where there's like more stuff to be said. Because ideally these people have memorized the parts, because that's what you're supposed to do, is be able to do it word perfect from memory. So, but most people don't. Nowadays, everybody just reads it out of the book because nobody has time to memorize it, and everybody gets away with it. Unless you're in a district where they're really sticklers. Some like Texas, you know, it's a stickler. And also in Massachusetts.
Well, did the lodges in your home state have the gradings? Would the district deputy grandmaster come in and grade and, you know, oh, points off, you got one word incorrect, points off, your movements sure. were not synchronized?
Yep. Yep, the official visit and inspections would happen, and they do that. And so that's the thing, Vinny. There's standards that are set. So here's the climate. You've got these busybody know-it-all guys who have memorized these rituals like little parrots. I mean, they can just chimp it out like little parrots. They just memorize it. And they think that they're good little masons because they know that ritual by heart, right? But you ask them anything about the ritual, like what does any of this mean, they have no answer for you. I'm talking 99% of the people have no real answer for you except the exoteric explanation that's in the material right in front of you, which is just a general overview. It doesn't give you anything to do with like symbolic instruction or real interpretation of what's being done and what you don't get any idea. If you go into a Freemasonic lodge, there is no instruction pointing out how much of the lodge is really a ceremonial magical ritual. It's going on all around you, but they don't tell you that. You don't know that. If you're a newcomer and you go into a lodge, they do not say this part of the magical ritual is this, or this identifies with this, or this resembles that, or no. It's not like that at all. It's matter-of-factly a Freemasonic ritual. It's all about a moral code. You know, you're basically getting a moral teaching and allegories and stuff like that. But yet, you know, if that's all Freemason really had to offer was more moral teachings for grown-up men who are probably were taught right and wrong growing up in home, church, and school. So if that's not really much more. It's like redundant. You know, there's got to be something more going on here, right? There is. But they're not telling you that overtly. It's up to you to decide if you want to figure that out. And if you don't want to figure it out or can't figure out how to ask, guess what? All the guys in the room who seem to be these smart guys, these older guys, the younger brothers like me who joined the lodge 7 years ago, we came in thinking that they were just, you know, they knew the answers, but they were holding back. They weren't going to tell us. We had to figure it out for ourselves. They'd lead us to the places that we could figure it out for ourselves. Baloney, man. In the end, they don't know anything either. They're pretending to know, and as long as you don't try to directly ask them questions, they won't have to lie. You know what I mean? Because they don't know. But they'd like you to think that they're just holding back and not telling you so you can figure it out for yourself. And, hey, guess what? Chances are, if you're one of those one percenters that might actually stumble onto the true understanding of things, you might get it figured out for yourself, right? And they could be like, see, I meant to do that.
Well, the old guys in the lodge sounds like their job is much the same as parents, you know?
Yeah, in many ways, you're stumbling along, just kind of making it up as you go along, right?
Yeah, pretty much, you know. I don't really know how your life's going to turn out, son. Okay, we'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen. We're taking a break at 3:33 and 33 seconds local New Zealand time. We'll see you after the break. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's a Dark Occulted Mysticism special with co-host Freda X. And our guest today is James Wright. And we're talking about this kind of a whole... It seems like almost like an old clan of old men that have no freaking thing really going on in their life. It's sort of like, have you ever seen old redneck drinking buddies or something like that? They literally have no other friends or anything better to do than just go out and drink with the same mates that they've been drinking with for the last 30, 40 years until they die of alcoholism with a pickled liver?
Yeah, or like the Dry Dock Sober Club, where they go down there and play gin rummy and drink bad coffee all day and complain about their lives.
You know, maybe this is one of those many outlets for people who don't have a life yet.
Well, like that audio that I leaked, I mean, that's one of the biggest questions you could ask from that is why these guys are honestly sitting around spending 6 hours doing what they're doing and talking about what they're talking about. Are you serious? And then the back to the secret thing, you know, well, if it's what they say it is, then what is the need for all of the secrecy? And they're just so adamant about that. That's what the whole point in that audio was.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, why would people be spending their time doing such as this, wasting their time with micromanaging somebody's lifestyles or otherwise accusing people in some sort of like trumped up, and that's just like the things they did to you, James, the trumped up charges that are produced to disqualify the individual for political reasons. If they can't marginalize them, if they can't preoccupy them or marginalize them, then they target them and destroy them. I've had high-ranking Masons in the district I moved to, not the original district I was in, but on the East Coast. I went to a brother who, you know, I confided in him what I was experiencing, especially from a couple of Scottish Rite Freemasons, again. And they were basically, I was sort of being harassed for just like being the smartest guy in the room. I mean, in all modesty, I came into a situation with a lot more knowledge than these guys, and they acted like they were the smartest guys in the room, and they didn't have the answers. And then I walked in from a whole different perspective and kind of turned everything upside down, and it upset the apple cart, basically. And so they were just, you know, I just started experiencing what you would get in that situation from the members. And I went to a brother and sort of confided in him and was like, you know, what's the story with these guys? And he told me straight up, he looked me right in the eyes and he said, look, you're coming into a situation where these guys think that they want to be known as the smartest guy in the room. And you've upset the apple cart. You've changed that whole status quo. And if you don't stop, they will target you and destroy you. And well, I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, that was like one of the last meetings I went to in that area.
Well, that's the common denominator in all of these cases, whichever one we're talking about, or mine, or whoever. You have a relationship between the person in question and the lodge or the Scottish Rite or whoever in question, and it's a relationship that works. And then at some point, it crosses a line where it turns into abuse and harassment. So then you have to ask yourself, can you tolerate it any longer?
Well, one thing people don't realize either is that there's so much money involved organizationally with the charities and then with other people's personal side ventures. There's business deals people don't know about that go on with lodge members. And then, of course, in the Grand Lodge lines in any state that has any kind of financial economy, a good economy, Grand Lodge systems, those guys, the Grand Master gets money. I mean, he makes money being a Grand Master. The secretary in the Grand Lodge makes money. These guys are paid salaries.
Yes,
yeah,
in case any Masons are listening and still thinking whatever preconceived notions they have about their local Scottish Rite chairman and secretary generals, the chairman and secretary general of every major city in America, that to my knowledge, gets paid a salary of $60,000 a year just to show up for the 1, 2, 3 hours a week that they come in and make sure that they're painting of them is polished and that everybody knows that they're in charge and then saunter on off. So
kind of like it's very much the role Dick Cheney played in the escalation of the war in Iraq. We're gonna go to war in Iraq. and then he goes away.
Yeah.
These people get the aggrandizement, show everybody that there's some kind of control structure, get paid a shockingly large amount of money for it, and have immunity from various types of laws, speeding tickets, etc.
So let me take that story a little bit further. The guy that told me I'd be targeted and destroyed. So then I pulled way back. This is a couple years ago. I was doing the radio show. doing the old broadcast there with Vinny, me and Vinny on AFR Network. And so I pulled back from local meetings altogether. I was freaked out by that conversation. I'm like, oh my God, what the hell have I got myself into here? So I like pulled back and I didn't go to anything. And then a couple of brothers reached out to me. Okay, a few months later, they reached out to me, the ones that I had gotten along with. It's always the guys you got along with best. They pick the right guys to reach out to you. And they're like, oh, we're trying to start this research lodge. You know, and they knew that was my pet project. That was one of the things that got me in trouble as I started talking about starting a research lodge. And the guys that were agents of the Grand Lodge and the Scottish Rite already had a statewide research lodge they had total control of. That they, you know, it was like completely totalitarian control of this thing. And they didn't want any independent lodges of research springing up that would be countering their program at all. It'd be too anarchistic, really. They couldn't have that, you know. So basically, I kind of stopped trying to make it happen. And then all of a sudden, a few months later, these brothers contact me and they say, yeah, we want to do it because I belong to an order called the Allied Masonic Degrees. The AMD councils are, by their very nature, in design, in their constitution, in their bylaws, a research body. And it's an exclusive invitation-only side order to Freemasonry, right? And they have their own 15 continental degrees that they brought over from France and Germany and turned them into, you know, this little degree system they offer as a little side research entity. And it's basically, the idea is that you would choose brothers who are of service to the lodge and are research oriented to be a member of this order. And then, you know, that the theory is that they would write paper, research and write papers that would be then presented back to the local area lodges, and it would cause other research minded Masons to join, and, you know, snowball effect, whatever. When you join the order, you're initiated into the Knights of Knights of Constantinople. That's the, you're made a Knight of Constantinople. So I had received that degree and gone through that order years before, but the local council I belonged to back in my home lodge district was a joke. They didn't really do. I eventually demitted from the council because it was a waste of time. Nobody's doing research. Nobody's presenting papers. Every time I would present a paper, it would be like crickets. Nobody would even respond to me. It was just like, you know, what? I just might as well throw that into a well. I got no response from my paper and my efforts. And I traveled from far away sometimes to go do this thing. But anyways, I still belonged when these brothers called me. And they were like, look, you're the only active member of this council in this whole entire district. And we need one active member to sign the charter application. We can't get a charter. And so this is why they called me. They wanted to use me to validate their incentive. And what they wanted to do, which I didn't know, was to create an exclusive little supper club where they all would wear tuxedos and they would invite their political allies from the lodges. They would, you know, wave this carrot under their nose about being made a Knight of Constantinople and a member of the Allied Masonic, AMD they call it, and they were going to bring them into it. And that's they wanted to be able to set up a little exclusive little club for their buddies and cronies. So once I got wind of all that, I got pissed because I realized I was being used right away, you know, and I wrote a letter to the Grand Council of the AMD back in Washington, D.C., and contacted the Secretary General, that's what he's called, of the Grand Council, right? And this, Vinny, is where you would cue the Star Wars Dark Empire music, because I got on the phone with the Emperor. From the dark side, from the Empire, right? And I'm talking to this guy, you know, and he's like, well, I wrote him a letter first and he ignored me. I had to really hunt him down. I had to contact him like for a week till I finally got a hold of him. And you know what he did? When I complained about specific Scottish Rite Masons in the area who had kind of like finagled this, I found out they were really the brains behind this whole thing. And as soon as they got that charter, they totally just marginalized X me right out of it. And I mean, I didn't go either, but they were glad that I didn't go. They didn't want me to go. So basically, I complained about these guys, and this Secretary General, he went and he contacted them. He didn't even contact me, Vinny. The complainer, you know, he contacted the people I was accusing and had a talk with them about me. And so when I called him and finally got him on the phone, I'm like, so, you know, I've been waiting for a response from you. He's like, oh, yeah, yeah. I'm like, did you get my letter? Yeah, I got it. So were you going to respond to what all the allegations I put forward? He said, yeah, I gave those guys a call. I'm like, excuse me? You called them and not me? Yeah, they said, we talked about it. Maybe you're just a little bit overreacting, don't you think, Joe? And, that was the way it went. And then they're like, hey, he said to me flat out, Vinny, all you got to do, if you don't like somebody, you're the secretary of the council. If you don't like somebody, you can just not send them a dues notice and suspend them for non-payment of dues. If you don't like somebody, you can target them and eliminate them from the council. This is the secretary general, national head, telling me this. I mean, I was aghast. I mean, I sat there and realized, oh my God, at the very highest level, these guys are corrupt to the point where he's telling me, you have absolute power. He said those words, absolute power. You are the absolute power behind that council. I was just aghast of the whole thing.
So yeah, he's trying to like sucker you in with the like power. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, James.
I was going to be witty and say that there's a lot of men in the ranks of Freemasonry who you could liken to the Emperor character. Yeah, but anyway, continue.
Well, the thing is, old, ugly, and bitter is quite the fascinating subgroup of people, and there's quite a lot of them. What I am really concerned about is more the fact that how many people actually call the quote-unquote Secretary General of that order and actually converse with them privately, not from a position of power themselves, but actually kind of like... having that big exactly. wake-up call right there, like this person's actually evil and corrupt, and is the person running the frickin' organization.
It was so scary. I mean, that's when I realized that, this was the point where I turned to my wife and said, okay, the beast reared his ugly head at me. I finally have come to contact with that agent of evil that we always suspected was lurking behind the drapes.
You have become an agent of evil. Unless you face
Vader. Hey, forget about it. Hey, forget about it. You got absolute power. You know what I'm saying, buddy?
Yeah, and talking about this AMD stuff, that one of their, what is it, their pinnacle degree is called the Super Excellent Master's Degree.
It sounds like Bill and Ted's Super Excellent Adventure.
No, totally. It's like Bill and Ted's Super Excellent Master Degree. Yeah. My wife always got a chuckle at that name. When I'm like, she's like, no, really? And I'm like, no. It's called a Super Excellent Master. This other one's called Most Excellent Master, Vinny.
Is there also a supercalifragilisticexpialidocious master degree?
They do. It's called the Rite of Miserium.
like the Mary Poppins Rite of Freemasonry? Well, where you like learn the different occult secrets about how to like fit an entire room into a small handbag.
Hey, Mater X wants it known for the record that she can say supercalifragilisticexpialidocious in pig Latin. Oh, did I lose you guys on that one?
Yeah, you did. I am my lovely wife are delivering me coffee. I didn't want to spoil that moment.
Coffee. That sounds good. Oh,
God, coffee is so damn good, man. Like, honestly. And in fact, this is another thing that I was thinking about before. Drug use. The whole freaking world's using drugs now. Right? Everybody. They're either on caffeine or weed or tobacco or alcohol or uppers, downers, zippers, poppers, goers, sunshine, salt shakers, whatever the frick, bath salts. Goodness knows what the hell is going on. Drugs are frickin' everywhere, right? And the whole idea behind taking drugs initially in the first place throughout history was to expand your mind. But unfortunately, people now are using them to escape from it.
Well, I mean, everybody is on drugs. You're absolutely right. All the people that used to tell me not to do drugs are on drugs now. But drugs weren't the thing you're talking about. Mind expansion. Those were the entheogens, the medicine, there was a difference. Drugs are pharmaceutical products that we've been convinced and coerced to need. My children, we constantly have to, re-educate our children constantly about how, you don't need to take a pill to solve it's not going to solve every problem.
Yeah.
To take a pill or a pharmaceutical product, because they are convinced by our culture that that is a requirement. You know, if you have an ailment of any kind, better living through pharmaceutical products, better living through chemistry, you know,
which have been linked to weight gain and suicide and just straight up death. Like this guy like looks at the packet of his pills and he goes, what are the side effects? Death. Whoa, hold on a bit. Like, I'll take this pill because I'm feeling a little bit down and you're saying it could kill me and that would be the first sign I'd see that something might go wrong?
If that's the pill that I'm taking so I don't feel suicidal, right? Now they got pills to take to make the other pill work. See, you got to take this pill to make that other pill you take work. If you don't take this pill, that one's not going to work. Sorry. It's a package deal.
Yeah. You have to swallow the fly and the spider and the chicken.
Meanwhile, in Colorado, right? In Colorado, they've got tens of millions of dollars in tax revenues from cannabis sales and crime is down. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Crime is down in Colorado.
Well, isn't that interesting? Imagine that. A massive revenue stream that organized crime suddenly has no access to anymore because it's freaking legal and taxable. Ah! Oh.
You know, organized crime, otherwise known as municipalities and governments.
Well, see, and I, in fact, it's funny you should mention that because I was talking on a thread today that was done by one of the Green Parties. We're having a large debate in New Zealand at the moment about legal synthetic highs and things of that nature. And of course, legal synthetic highs wouldn't freaking exist if the real stuff that can get you high was legal. What at? You know? There's a whole bunch of people who get piss tested for work and what have you all the time that have to smoke the synthetic stuff, which has way, way worse side effects than the real deal. And my argument was precisely what you said. You know, there's something going on here. There's organized crime. And who says that the organized crime aren't being in business and aren't in business with the government who make the substance illegal because they're criminals too?
Yeah, well, they're getting it at both ends. They're just playing both sides of the field. They got to make sure they can collect on all. But luckily, there's enough going on here. I mean, they're talking about just millions of dollars in taxes that are being generated from the medical marijuana sales in Colorado. That, I mean, to me, it's like however you want to shape it. The proof is in the pudding. These guys can't deny the money coming in taxes and the freaking lower crime.
And this is lower, you know, overall crime, like less murders, less rapes, less that, well, kind of thing?
They say that just crime in Denver, which I lived in Denver, and let me tell you, that is a scary city. That is like bars on the window. Scary city, especially. I mean, there's obviously nice parts of town, but the working class and lower classes, boy, it's... You have the Make My Day law in Denver, right? Where you can have a loaded weapon in your door, and if somebody comes in, you can shoot them dead right in your house, and you're acquitted. It's a Make My Day law, and you know that was in Denver. But yeah, it's declined. Crime has declined.
They actually made a law referencing a line from a Dirty Harry movie.
Yes, they did, Vinny. Yes, they did.
You got to love America, bro. They're so cultured.
It is remarkable, isn't it?
I mean,
it's not the first thing that we could say.
I don't have like kind of a monument to Clint Eastwood, like so, like the man with no name with a cigar hanging out his mouth or something like that, and a six shooter. Nothing like that. That kind of deification of the Wild West. You know, hey, it's Colorado. Why not?
Probably. I mean, we've got Sylvester Stallone, Rocky image. Bronze in Philadelphia, so.
Really?
I think so, yeah. I haven't seen it personally, but I believe there is one.
These are our gods now, ladies and gentlemen. You know?
There's an 11-foot-tall bronze statue of Albert Pike in Washington, D.C., man, and he was a war criminal. He was friggin' found guilty of treason. He was a suspected assassin of one of the assassins in Lincoln.
Well, that's why he's in Washington, D.C., bro. I mean, nobody else there isn't a war criminal.
What a better person for them to use as the body for the 31st degree than his big ass.
His giganto. He was a big man. He was like a giant. You know, he's probably one of those small giants, right? What about Giants, Vinny? We haven't talked about Giants. You know, this whole Giant craze. There's a big resurgence in the Giant research. What do you think of all this?
I'm 6 foot four. I'm always into studying my family.
Right. Well, I mean, bottom line here is that it turns out in America alone, there was hundreds of thousands of mounds, building, giant remain discoveries all over this country. In the 19th century, it was a given that giants existed in America in the past. And that many of the Indian tribes, the Paiute Indians, for example, they had a book, the book called My Life with the Paiutes, where their ancient history, they talked about having to fight and murder and basically wipe out a giant race, a giant tribe that was eating them. And so they had to, they've ran them into a hole in the ground and then burned them out.
But, just like the Cyclops in the Odyssey.
Exactly. And maybe it's a monomyth, who knows? But I'll tell you one thing, it is remarkable. And, you know, even Lincoln had a speech in like 1844 where he mentioned the giants and the mound builders in his speech. He referred to them matter-of-factly, like, you know, he said something about the remains all over America of the giants, the race of giants who once walked the land. And that, you know, that was in the 19th century. And yet the report is one after another of the Smithsonian Institute stepping in at the last minute. I mean, we've researched it ourselves. One after another, they have the Smithsonian Institute stepping in at the last minute and sweeping away all the remains and wheeling them into that big giant room where they put the Ark of the Covenant at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and it's gone forever. You know what I mean? Like, no label, sorry.
There's actually been a large cover-up in Dallas, of all places. In Dallas, there's an eastern suburb called Rockwall, and the reason it's called Rockwall is because when it was being named, they decided to name it that after the giant rock wall that are these mounds that are clearly built by something intelligent or whatever, and they resonate and this, that, the other. But the point is that when they were first settling that area, like turn of the century, 1900, you know, back then, they were excavating and they were pulling out more of these giant skeletons that you sometimes see pictures of or whatever. But yeah, there's just been this this curtain of silence on those things, and they're sitting right there in the middle of Rockwall in Dallas, and you might not even know that you're driving beside one or whatever, but you are, and it's just any information that's ever come up about that, it seems like it is made to die off really quickly, kind of like if you are a caller to Coast and say the F word.
What were you going to say, Vinny? You were going to ask or ask a question or say something there?
Well, I was thinking, what's the significance about ancient giants? I mean, it occurs to me that these are simply the Anunnaki stories, the half human, half alien kind of hybrid creatures that came out giant, like in the legends.
Well, here's the significance, man. Here's what it is. Here's the big significance. Look, we are under the illusion and paradigm of Darwinian evolution, okay? So we go from simple to complex, you know, big to little, little to big, whatever, over the evolution over long periods of time, small incremental changes that improve the species, right? The whole idea of giants coming into the mix throws that entire paradigm out of whack. Okay.
Well, that's not just the only element that throws it out of whack.
Oh, sure.
Almost the entirety of reality puts the theory of evolution in the shitter.
Absolutely.
Pardon?
But I think that's what was prevailing. That was the prevailing motivating factor at the time. The guys that were involved in education in America in the 19th century, the early compulsion schooling education, there was a huge, massive nationwide international campaign to unify and standardize English, and not just English, but education in general, to meet the needs and goals of the, you know, the power elite, the social engineers.
The industrialists at the time.
Industrialists, exactly, right. So think about that. We can't have these, like, errant ideas of, like, you know, other species running around, maybe dinosaurs cavorting with man. I mean, what is all this? We can't let this happen. It throws our whole theory out of whack about the way things are and what we're trying to teach kids, you know, about things. So that's a big thing, I think. That was a huge part of it. I mean, Catalina Island off of L.A. alone, they had a museum up until the 1930s where they were showing exhibits of thousands of giant remains. They were selling pieces of bones in the gift shop, giant bones. I mean, it was that big of a deal. And then in the and that was the Wrigley family, Wrigley Chewing Gum. They owned that museum. And then in the 30s, it was all shut down, boxed up, and taken away. There was 500 photographs of the remains of giants. Vinny,
I
it
guess
won.
They, I guess they didn't manage to wriggle out of that one.
They didn't wriggle out of that one, did they? They wanted to double their pleasure, though. You know, double whatever.
Speaking of speaking of which, we have one more segment and one more break. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with more from the Dark Occult of Mysticism show with Rainer Eggs, Vinny Eastwood, and our special guest James Wright.
Unforgettable, that's what you are. Unforgettable, though near or far, like a song of love that clings to me. How the thought of you does things to me. Never before has someone been more unforgettable.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen. It's the final segment now going into the final rush. And we've just heard about the Wrigley Chewing Gums family's giant museum where you could buy giant bones in the gift shop like you were in freaking the Flintstones. you know, it reality is a real weird one, ladies and gentlemen. And here's the thing. All of this stuff has been seen in movies, isn't it? Okay, as far as I'm concerned, this is why I watch more movies, and this is actually one of the ways I do my research into popular culture, is I like watching movies. I've got a long attention span, and I'm a stickler for remembering little quips and details and things. And it seems that almost every fantasy film that I've ever seen, or sci-fi film that I've ever seen, is either influenced by things from the past or things from the present, which are very, very real and documented and chronicled. Now, I mean, let's not kid ourselves here. Hollywood doesn't have that much creativity left, ladies and gentlemen. Maybe it never did. There's a hell of a lot of bad films out there. And even the good ones are simply retellings of old stories, aren't they? I'm wondering if there's such a thing as originality anymore. Like something truly unique and real that isn't a reimagining or a restructuring or a refabricating of something that has already been. So if they show you a sci-fi film, ladies and gentlemen, they're showing you what's about to come into fruition. If they're showing you a fantasy film, ladies and gentlemen, it's an allegory of what's already happened and what used to be around. Just my thoughts.
Oh, I agree. I think that it's all retrofit, retrograde. We're constantly being we're recycling themes that work, and that there's a deliberate. That's another like resonant conditioning, resonance. Like if you put one vibrating object next to another object that can vibrate or is vibrating at a different frequency, the the greater vibrating object will overtake the other one. The other one will begin to resonate with it and create and have the same. It'll basically align itself with the frequency that is greater. So what's a greater frequency if not redundancy, being repeated over and over again? The same things being repeated over and over again to us is like a redundant frequency. It just keeps resonating over and over again. And we will adopt that. We will sync up with that. We will vibrate and reflect that back. Our brains are susceptible. Our thought patterns are susceptible to that. That's we are so, you know, in many ways, it's a flaw of consciousness to be able to be fooled. What did Mark Twain said it? It's easier to fool a man than to convince him he's being fooled. It is easier to fool a man than to convince him that he's being fooled. And we are like that. Every life in reality is like a three-card Monty game where you're just trying to follow the queen of reality all around you. It's just that's the way I feel many times. Like I'm constantly playing a game of catch-up. And that's the hardest factor when you're thinking about dark occulted mystics sculpting your reality, because they're 10 steps ahead of us.
Have you ever had a laser pointer and you played with a cat and the cat goes after it and all of that kind of stuff, and no matter how many times he slaps his paw down on it, the red dot appears on the top of his paw and he keeps trying to slap it, and then it goes on the floor and he doesn't get it. It's not freaking real. You're just being played with, cat.
We're just like that cat with the laser pointer. That's exactly how I feel all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I try to react to things all around me, and then sometimes I stop myself and I go, am I really seeing what I think I'm seeing, or am I just making it up in my mind? And what's even real anyway? What the hell is reality? What the hell is everybody talking about? Why can't people communicate properly? Why are they abusing me? And all of this kind of stuff, this constant cycle. It's like it's almost like you're sitting in a satellite in space, and you're looking down on the Earth, and below you, there's this enormous storm system, and it looks really beautiful, really peaceful. And right next to you, next to the window, that you can see this really peaceful, beautiful looking storm system, there's hundreds of video feeds from underneath the storm, and you're seeing everybody's life being torn apart by it. That's kind of what decoding reality is like for me. I look around and it's like calm and peaceful and there's nothing. And then all you do is look a little bit closer at something on a screen, and then you see it all going to hell.
That's really dark, man. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, but it's very true, isn't it? You know,
actually it is.
You look deeper into anything, you see a whole cascade of crap. You know,
it's easy to get overwhelmed. It's easy to get caught up. You know, you can feel as if like you said, everything is made up. You know, there's a book out there called The Wrecking Crew, which talks about how all the music that I loved from the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s, the great songs of the keg parties and, you know, the background soundtracks to all the great movies and all that, they're all, according to this book, all of them were recorded by the same 10 people. All of them. All the songs we heard where you thought it's Clapton doing it or whoever, whatever, it's all done by the same. They were called the Wrecking Crew. They were a stable, a professional artist that could do it perfect every time. And I'm convinced that it's true. I mean, they really, the book does a great job of putting down the case that these record producing companies needed to have that track laid down quickly, concisely, and consistently. And they couldn't wait around for rock stars to produce hit after hit every 3 months that they could sell to waiting teenagers. You know what I mean? So they had to have a crew that would do it. And then they'd let the rock stars go out and tour it, you know, and be the players out live and do the work there. And they were all contracted. That's what the whole thing with the Monkees, you know, that whole myth about the old pop culture group, the Monkees, you know who they are, Vinny?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So they had a TV show and all that in the 60s. Those guys were contracted as actors, but they were actual street musicians in the hippie scene in the 60s, but they were brought in as actors. So they had a contract. They were told to come in, play a part, sing the role, and then get out. And they wanted to be musicians. So they fought with the company the whole time. And eventually they got a chance to put out an album and go on a tour. But what happened? They got exposed as frauds, you know? And everybody thought, whoa, it's a fraud. The Monkees aren't really doing their own plan. But all the other musicians on the charts were all freaking out. Like they were, a bunch of like 33rd degree Scottish rites sitting there going like, oh shit, they might know we're, sorry, I didn't mean to say that, but they might know we're faking it. They might know we don't know anything. You know, they didn't want anybody else to know that these other bands, I mean, all the bands of the 60s and 70s and stuff, were playing the music live and they were putting their mark on it. But all the studio work and all the radio tracks that we were hearing and growing up with were done by the same 10 people, the Wrecking Crew. So everything's fake. Everything's made up. Everything we think is real. So all the kids that sat in their basements trying to emulate that track and trying to get that and think, dreaming about the rock star that was singing on the stage and thinking, how can he do it like that? I can't. It's because he didn't do it. It was a Wrecking Crew guy who did it in the studio. The guy that's too ugly to be on stage, but he's a perfect maestro. You know what I mean? In the back studio in a dark room with a chain around his arms or something. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, the Beatles stopped touring right at the height of their career and then produced like four or five more albums. Who said that wasn't done by all the freaking studio musicians, you know?
Well, I don't know, though.
Alan Watt, I believe, another occult researcher, he used to be a session musician, actually. And he tells a very similar account to what you're saying, bro.
Yeah, well, then, of course, Jimmy Page was a sessions musician who made the crossover. A few of them can pull it off. You know, Slash from Guns N' Roses was one of those guys. He was a session musician for a long time. He was a hired gun, you know, a hired axeman brought in. But then he made the crossover with the band Guns N' Roses. So the thing is, though, right, is that it changed. They made a point of saying that the Wrecking Crew changed. It started in the late 50s, early 60s, you know, even like the Phil Spector factory studio hit factory, you know, where the producer would actually either write the song himself or have a songwriter, and then he would handpick the team of musicians to produce the music, and then he would have a band that would be like the front band that would go out and tour it. It would be like the pretty face on the package. So there's a real operation going on here. So guys like Phil Spector, they couldn't wait around for their temperamental, you know, dramatized like band people that were like, you know, like, okay, for example, my band for my show, Systemic, who did the theme song for the first 3 years of broadcasting my show, they spent an entire year producing one song. An entire year, okay? No record company in that time could have done that. They couldn't let a band take an entire year to produce one song. They would be out of business. They need a hit from him or them every few months to market to the teenagers, which keeps the wheels rolling, which keeps them in business. And so that's the way it was. So they had to have these axemen that were hired guns in the studio ready to put that track down the first time. It wasn't going to take them 50,000 takes. They were going to get it probably the first or second take and move on to the next thing. You know, it'd be like, okay, that's good. Rap, take another one. You know, and that's how they would do it. And that, you know, so think about it. Logistically, I can understand why that would be the role that they would take. But what it does is it creates this facade. For us, we're thinking that music is one thing when it's another. I mean, that's why it's not a great jump to all the bands we have now, like Backstreet Boys or Britney Spears or any, you know, all these fake bands and fake musicians that are just figureheads. They're put in place and it's not real. It's just a money grabbing industry like any other in entertainment, you know, diversion and captivation.
There's a reason they call it the music business. It's because it's not about the music. It's about business.
That's right. Exactly. You still with us, James?
Oh, yes.
Have you got something to interject? My son, you've been kind of quiet there. We're supposed to be interviewing him, Freda. We're bad hosts.
We're
like the Alex Joneses of the occult world. I'm going to talk over your guest. I promise to take your calls.
No, actually, I was lost in thought wondering why Madonna hasn't had a new single out in years now. They must have given up on her.
Have you seen the footage? Did you see Jamie Freeman's wife, their new Weird Stuff magazine? They put up some new pictures from the. It's on their Facebook page, guys. But they got this one of Madonna and also one of Britney Spears, like before and after photos, like where they touched them up with the computer touch-ups. Oh, man, you got to check this stuff out. It's unbelievable, the difference. I mean, from the haggard look that they are to like what's on the cover of the magazine, it's just like, wow, I can't believe that. It's like so artificial. It's completely, we are through the looking glass. That's all I got to say. To do with the picture, what they do with the voices, with the electronic tunes, you know, auto-tuning.
Hmm.
They auto-tune their faces.
Wow. Mate, that'd be quite interesting. I wonder how many.
I'll try to find the photo and forward it to you.
Well, we were talking about music before and how long it actually takes to make a song. And my friend Mikhail, it was his birthday just yesterday, I think. No, day before yesterday, sorry. And the Happy Birthday song that we did, it's like a beautiful song. It's really, really good. Don't mean to blow my own trumpet or nothing, but everybody who hears it says the exact same thing. It's a freaking awesome song. That was recorded initially, like we just jammed it out in a night. And then the very next day, we rewrote it, rehearsed it, recorded it, and we have a finished song. So it took in total about 24 hours from inception to finish song. I don't know many musicians who can do that.
Only Jack White, right, from White Stripes?
Really?
That guy holds a record. He just got the I swear, if you look this up, he's got the world record for the fastest produced pop album. He just produced the fastest in history.
How long did it take him?
I can't remember. It's like days. I mean, literally days. Just so short of amount of time. And he does it on like a shoestring budget, and he makes millions in sales.
Wow. Well, I suppose it's actually reasonably easy if you've got just drums and a guitar, and that's the White Stripe sound. It's not a hell of a lot more you can do with it.
But he does expand a lot of it in the studio. But nowadays, with all the things you can do with a, I mean, you know, and I know what one person can do now compared to what it took a whole crew and thousands of dollars of equipment to do before.
Yeah, I mean, it's been doing like that for a while now. I mean, I've produced albums for people. It's quite freaking easy, you know. You get them in, you record song, not albums. Sorry. There was one album that I helped a lady produce, but that was her talking and doing a presentation that you'd sell on an audio CD, but not, you know, done our own album, I guess. That's on the website of the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. And when it comes to music, I'm also very interested in the devolution of music. Not necessarily the evolution, but the devolution. An older friend of mine commented one time when we were sitting around having a few drinks about how there aren't any songs that everybody knows anymore, right? You ever wonder that? He was like walking around in stores in the 70s and early 80s and, you know, a song would come on the radio at the store and everybody in the store would be singing it, kind of thing. It was like this very homogenous culture in terms of musical participation. And what's happened now is that originally there were only so many genres and so many artists, etc. But now that music has kind of grown from its infancy in the recording and technology realm, it's actually split off into all these separate subcategories. Hundreds and thousands of different genres of music are now available and all influencing each other and splitting off in little offshoots and things, kind of like Freemasonry in a way. And what's happened was where music used to bring people together, now it's forcing them apart because you've got very little in common.
I think you got something that goes right along with what we've been kind of a theme of tonight's talk, the Prussian model of the dehumanization of culture and society through the breakdown of values, family, tradition, and the replacement of other values and traditions, you know, ones that are state manufactured and state reinforced.
I like the term scum. You know, I mean, many people like to call people who are still slaves, you know, I mean, I used to be a slave mentality person all the way up. The thing I believed in the government, believed that cops were truthful and not corrupt. That's just laughable now. And most of them. There's a few of you out there that aren't corrupt. But once you have that big realization, that kind of aha moment, you kind of see yourself differently to other people who still believe in all of that kind of stuff. Like you're simply not the same person. Have you realized that? Since you have realization, you are so not the same person, and you interact and view other people that you don't even know with this kind of almost like the Terminator, you know, where how it like targets in and all this information just starts going. you know, and for mine it says like slave scum, hippie, new age, or little crip gangster kind of thing. And it's like chronicling and categorizing everything around me. And for some reason, I think that I'm better than these people. I'm like, well, I'm like rolling around because I'm aware of how the world is run, at least to a greater degree than these people do, that I have some kind of value that they don't. And I caught myself thinking this, and I was like, whoa. You're developing a superiority complex. You're developing elitism. And that means if you follow that through to its logical conclusion, you'll become exactly the same thing as these people that you're trying to stop from enslaving you and everybody else. And I have seen a lot of truthers follow this mentality through to its logical conclusion. And now they've told me privately, a lot of people that I know closely in the movement, that they're actually quite okay with a great culling of humanity and 90% of people just disappear, get exterminated or whatever, because they're stupid, you know, they haven't woken up, whatever, who cares?
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, who's gonna tell me this, and I'm like, whoa.
Who's going to decide? That's what I want to know. Who's going to do the deciding? We're going to get the Bush family to do the deciding on that or what?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even if you are aware of the New World Order and the control structure and what have you, you're not freaking part of it. You don't get to make the decisions. You'll be exterminated with the rest of us, mate. If there is an extermination, and if you sit back and do nothing about it and choose to not play your part in the salvation of humanity from the ecumenical scumbaggery that besets us, you don't deserve life anyway.
Well, luckily, in the immortal words of Bill Hicks, it's all just a ride. Anyways, right? That's the bottom line. Gosh.
I don't know. For me, it's real.
It takes a whole bunch to make it all turn around.
For me, it's real, guys. Like, I was out there. I was out having a cigarette on the back lawn. And I was thinking about, like, I've killed ants, I've killed chickens, and I've killed lots of animals and stuff like that. And I have no qualms about doing it, slapping mosquitoes, etc. And I was like, why? Why do I do that? You know, I like come on to play computer games and I kill lots of things on that as well. I like killing. And that was the conclusion I got from this questioning. Why do I kill these things? Because I like killing. I think it's fun. And I think that I'm better. And better as an organism. And I deserve life more than they do. And at the end of the day, I'll just kill them because it's fun. And I had that realization. It was like what I've been doing. And it's like, whoa. Wow, my God, I'm a freaking monster, right? I'm a human being who has infinite potential, infinite consciousness and what have you, and I'm here on this planet possibly as a guardian for broader humanity and organisms in general, and I can actually inject something positive into the thing, but what do? I enjoy killing it instead. What the hell is going on with my head? And I think this is actually kind of something that's shared by a lot of people out there. Violent video games, violent movies. We're surrounded by death at all times. Reminders of it, sigils, etc. And we're not actually surrounded all the time with the reminder that this isn't a game. This is real, and the consequences of our actions when we kill something, whether it be ant or flea or mosquito, it has a ripple effect, consequences. And it depends whether or not we're going to make this a positive ripple effect and allow the other organisms, including our own fellow brethren, survive around us, or whether or not we're going to give in to the selfish elitism that besets us in the first place and become the very thing that we hate.
I'm going to have to start calling you Swami Vinny Eastwood here in a minute. I just want you to know that.
Swami, is that like a shawarma?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I think that you're just
good with lettuce and...
You sound like you're on the path to enlightenment here, man. You know? No, but seriously, folks, once again, let me say, what you're saying is not a new idea for those like Mark Passio. His whole carnism talk is with regards to the idea that the meat industry in our cultures basically harms the animal spiritually before it's slaughtered, and that transfers to the meat. And that we consume the meat that has been harmed spiritually, that they cause a great anxiety and fear and horror in the animals before they slaughter them, and that's transferred into the meat, and that we eat that meat, and then we absorb that anxiety and that horror and that trauma, and it becomes part of our general brain chemistry through the protein. So there's some theories out there that kind of go along with what you're saying. The idea that if we upset the electrical universe of life all around us, that we will have a feed. There is a feedback. There is an effect. But at the same time, when you describe the morals that, you know, when you describe the idea of how we all, that there is a sort of like satanification, like Freeman and Mark talk about the satanification of our culture through video games, through television, through the desensitization. I mean, like the primetime television is shocking. And I consider myself a very high tolerance for inappropriate talk and behavior, but I have small children and there's a lot of times that I'm shocked at what comes out of a primetime TV set nowadays. When I say primetime, I'm talking dinner time and after, you know, like the normal, the normal television viewing time in American households, where it used to be, you know, George Carlin got brought up on charges, you know, for violating the 5 or 7 words you couldn't say on TV, you know, and same with Lenny Bruce and all this stuff, you know, but they got violence and sex and swearing and all that right there. It's just on, you know, the broad daylight, no problem. And the violence on the prime time television, I mean, with like Walking Dead, for example, these zombie shows, it's like, it's only so far that you can say, well, it's a zombie, you know, like, well, it's an alien, well, it's a, you know, werewolf, well, it's a, you know, vampire, whatever. When they're, yeah, when in they're beating their heads open with like everyday objects and that you find in your household and dismembering people. And it's like, this is dinner. Are we watching this while we're eating dinner? I mean, is this what we're doing? Because it doesn't seem possible to me, you know, and, so what is that? Desensitize, just all of us being made to accept. And what about the fact that, Vinny, what do you think of how the idea that people will shield their children from sex on TV, but they won't shield them from violence? Like if you're watching something that's sexually revealing. Parents, I think 9 times out of 10, parents will react if it's a sexually explicit scene quicker than if it's a violent scene. Or they'll even choose a violent context over a sexual context to allow their children to watch. And I'm talking about not like porn. I'm talking about just a, you know, suggestive scene, like in a show where you're not seeing anything, but you know they're making love in a bed or whatever. People are like, oh, you know, the kids in the room, change the channel, right? Go right to like Walking Dead where they're beating somebody's head open with a golf club. And that's okay. What do you think of that?
I think satanic inversion operates under the practice of making everything that's good the exact opposite. So where once entertainment could teach us very important lessons about life and maybe even give us some information at the same time, it's now coercing our conformity into a system that doesn't care about us so that we don't even care about ourselves anymore. That's what I think. And it's the end of the segment anyway. Freighter, could you give off your website and James too, and then we've got to go.
Yeah, go ahead, James.
Okay, it's dialmformason.weebly.com, and you can find me on Facebook, James Robert Wright.
Freighter?
And we've got a week, my wife and I, Materex, we have a weekly podcast we're doing on SyncBook Radio Network over at The Sync. Spelled S-Y-N-C book.com, thesyncbook.com. And my website is middlechamberfx.wordpress.com. And we have a Facebook page, which is first name FreighterX, last name MaterX. We share a page and we have the Middle Chamber Facebook page. And I really want to thank James for putting up with us doing all the talking and joining us here. Vinny, it was once again a pleasure and a delight and an honor to share the waves with you. And we'll look forward to another installment of the Dark Cult of Mysticism show.
Damn, I'm good. And also, ladies and gentlemen, you can check out me at the Vinny Eastwood show.com. That's Vinny with a Y because it's the most important question in Eastwood, as in go ahead, make my news. And also the go ahead, make my day law. And you can donate to me on that page there, or set up a regular subscription or something of that nature if you like the whole idea of getting in different people who are really educated and you basically just bring them into a more or less cafe-like environment where we're able to relax and sit down and have a chat about things that actually truly concern us and really open up, unlike the mainstream media does, who just kind of like set you up or give you an interrogatory interviews that really you don't get to say anything without getting into frickin' rupted. I hate that. If you hate it too, and you love this show, then please keep it alive. Go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and donate or start up a subscription today. We'll see you again sometime.